Hello there. Would you like a tangerine? Or perhaps a lemon? I'm Craig, and this is another oneliner.com podcast. With me as always, Scott Morris.
Hello.
And Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
Would either of you like a tangerine?
No, thank you.
I'm good. I'm good, thanks.
I'm surrounded by the ungrateful. Four cheeky little movies to speak to you about this time around, so without further ado, let's crack on. Right, all sort of fruit-based observations aside, I believe we're going to kick off this podcast with Flight. Drew, fill us in on Flight.
Okie dokie. So, bloody Denzel Washington. His performances are always so bloody predictable. Give him any role, and even if the rest of the film is terrible, he'll almost certainly be great. Predictable, see? And give him something he can really get his teeth into, and likely he'll be excellent, as he is here in Flight. I don't know what old Denzel thinks he's going to achieve with all this consistency. The bastard. Washington plays Captain Whip Whitaker, an airline pilot whose plane suffers a catastrophic mechanical failure mid-flight. His immense flying ability and intuition enable him to bring the plane to ground in the least disastrous manner possible, causing the deaths of only a handful of those on board and not the near 100% fatality figure that would have occurred had anybody else been in control. What makes this feat even more remarkable is that he did it while high on cocaine and with several times the legal alcohol limit for driving a car in his blood. So while he's being heralded as a hero in the nationwide media, Whitaker must face a federal inquiry into the crash, in which the issue of his boozy blood test will be brought up. Now, it's an odd name for this film, Flight, not just because that's a terrible name, but because it's really got almost nothing to do with what the film is actually about. And it may as well be called Drive, or Vomit, or Lamppost, as the crash of the plane is just the starting point for Whitaker to take a look at himself and his coming to terms with his alcoholism. And we're given no doubt that he's an alcoholic. Binned bottles must number in hundreds, and at one point we see Whip buy a bottle of vodka so big I imagine the label must read not 2 litres but all the vodka. Yet he continues to deny to himself that he has a drinking problem. Now, the film really after that follows his struggles with alcoholism, his actual coming to terms with the fact that he's an alcoholic, admitting it to himself, and it's all fairly standard stuff for a film about substance abuse. What sets it apart from so many others so is the cast and their performances. Washington is magnificent. His performance as a drunk in denial is absolutely compelling, and he has excellent support from a strong cast, notably recovering heroin addict Kelly Riley, who rises above the fact that her character is very, very conveniently placed to meet Whitaker, but she becomes an emotional centre point and foil for him. It's relatively predictable how it goes. It's not going to win any awards for story, and there's not a great deal more to say about the film itself because you know how it's going to go. If you've seen a film like this before, you know the basic plot. As I say, it's the performance. I've read the ending described as being too Hollywood, which is pretty fair, but it really is the performances that matter here. They're excellent throughout, and on that count I'd highly recommend it. The other notable thing perhaps is that we're reminded that Robert Zemeckis actually is capable of helming a pretty decent film when he's not fanning about with mocap. You know, he's now stopped in the Uncanny Valley and gone back to actual humans, you realise he's not a bad filmmaker at all, which is nice.
Is that a fair summation, Scott?
I believe so. I can't really add too much to that. Tremendous performance from Denzel Washington. I like that an awful lot. There's an awful lot of good performances out there. I did actually quite like the ending. I thought, for something that you think is going to be amazingly predictable, it does take a couple of, not exactly twists, but it throws you a few curveballs towards
banks.
The end. I did kind of appreciate that. It wasn't going like completely obvious all the way down, so I thought that was quite well handled.
Perhaps not. I mean, I wouldn't say I disliked the ending, but just some of it felt quite Hollywood. And
yeah, probably no more so than actually landing that plane, though.
Maybe there's sort of an assumed criticism in me saying that, but I don't really mean that because it's not necessarily a bad thing. It fits with the film.
Yeah.
But again, because the story really never mattered anyway. Not really.
Yeah, and it's mainly just that performance from Washington and tremendous support, particularly the bit part from John Goodman, which is always
a hoot
to watch. Yes, very much enjoyed it. Heartily recommend it. Go and watch it.
Do that. Do that now. So then, on to Beasts of the Southern Wild, which takes place somewhere between reality and the imagination of its 6-year-old protagonist Hush Puppy, played to awards-worthy acclaim by newcomer Cuvitzani Wallace, who was in fact only 5 at the time of filming. Set in the bayous of Louisiana, Beast follows the trials of Hush Puppy and her fellow residents of the fictional community of Bathtub, a small dwelling isolated from the mainland by a symbolically oppressive levee, As they cope with encroaching floodwaters brought on by a seemingly prophetic melting of the polar ice caps, those ice caps in turn hearkening the onset of a recurring visual metaphor that will eventually confront our young heroine in a decisive and increasingly fantastical final act. At first it seems Hush Puppy is a neglected child, her mother a distant memory, and her father, Wink, a nebulous drunken presence at best. Through various hardships it soon transpires that there is in fact a reason why Wink seems so aggressive and cold towards his daughter, and the film builds to an emotional climax that mixes a touching revelation with the adventurous, imagination-fueled naivety of its young protagonist. Coming as it does in the pre-Katrina age, a lot can be read into Beast's assorted metaphors, but ostensibly it is a simple coming-of-age tale that succeeds admirably in walking a fine line between fantasy and reality, and evokes a very particular atmosphere that is pleasingly difficult to pin down. I think it's safe enough to say that eventually I enjoyed Beasts of the Southern Wild, but to me, it certainly felt like a film that made me work for that enjoyment.
Yeah, it took a while to get into it for me.
Yeah, without giving away anything, it wasn't actually until that sort of final act, or at least the last couple of reels of the film, that, this is going to sound daft, that I actually realised I had enjoyed the first hour of it also. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, because I felt almost exactly the same. I know exactly what you mean. It's hard to describe, but yes.
Atmospherically, I mean, not... Well, atmospherically, maybe atmospherically and stylistically, it's a little oblique for the first hour or so, and it all sort of comes together in the end. But there's no denying the performance from Cuvizzani Wallace, whose name I know has proven difficult for most people to pronounce over the last couple of months and the awards she's been up with, so I hope I'm doing it justice. I'm loath to use her nickname, which I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce it, but it's spelt N-A-Z-I-E. So I want to steer clear of that, because I don't want to be accusing someone who is now only 7 years old of being some sort of fascist kind of fundamentalist. Yes. Some really fantastic performances, and I haven't seen a film like this in a long while, and ultimately it was quite rewarding. Drew, you have much to say.
I have very little to say, in fact, because I enjoyed this, but I couldn't satisfactorily put into words why.
No.
I was really struggling to marshal my thoughts on this, but actually I noticed what you tweeted about it, and that summed it up quite well for me, which was quietly heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Which is a good way to describe the tone of it by the end.
Yeah, yeah. If not the build-up.
It's not something you could unreservedly advise people to watch. It's not an easy watch, but it's rewarding. I really am struggling here to put into words quite how I felt, but I've still not, a couple of weeks later after seeing it, still not quite fully marshalled my feelings about it.
No.
But the fact that I can't put those feelings into words well, but I would still recommend that a lot of people might want to see it, probably says quite a lot.
Yeah, definitely. I think part of the enjoyment of it is a sort of challenge of trying to qualify exactly why I found it so, and probably enjoyable is not the word, but satisfying by the end. Scott, have you had any greater success in putting your emotions one way or t'other into words?
Well, I only watched it last night, so it's not really sunk in properly.
Mm.
By the end, I enjoyed it. I was slightly disappointed because I was expecting this to be the best film of last year from what people had said. Right? It didn't blow me away in that respect. And indeed, the first 5 minutes or so are so willfully hipster that I almost turned it off in disgust. But when they have this big parade, it looks like it could be an advert for a artisanal beer company. That was almost enough to make me go, nah, not my cup of tea, and just stop it. But I'm glad that I went on through it.
It felt like it wanted to be filmed through sort of an Instagram filter or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
The final act kind of makes it for me. It's a tremendously powerful film, probably because of the age of the protagonist. I suppose that might be where a hell of a lot of this stuff gets pinioned around, because it does make for a kind of powerful impact to the events towards the end of the film. And the rest of it has a very pleasing fairy tale quality to it that works for the most part. It took maybe 45 minutes or so. It took about half the film for me to actually really get properly warmed up to it.
Mm.
I don't know how well this will reward repeat viewing. I suspect I might enjoy it a little bit more on the second time round, having kind of already got over that hump.
Yeah, I was thinking, I think it's certainly something that would reward a second viewing, and certainly something I enjoyed more than enough the first time round to want to watch it again.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not one for sitting and picking apart and analysing the themes of films or anything like that, but I think if you were going to do it with any films, this would be the one to do it for.
Yeah.
You could write several nice long essays about it, but that's just not the way I roll. However, I still recommend it to anyone who has any kind of interest in the sort of art of cinema. I think if you're more interested in that kind of more sort of film theory side of things especially, then you'll get a hell of a lot of enjoyment out of Beasts of the Southern Wild. For casual audiences, if it's just something you're kind of stumbling across and watching, I can see it maybe being a bit too affected, I guess, for want of a better term, for some audiences, but I still think it'd be worth looking.
It's a very complete package in all but the sort of mass mass market appeal, in that I think on first viewing, certainly, I expected to be more focused on the performances because, like you say, it comes with a lot of quite a weight of expectation. It's gathered quite a lot of momentum throughout awards period, and like you say, a lot of people have been talking about this in sort of film of the year terms. It's one of those little films that's popped up that's a lot of people have mentioned it as their kind of wild card. But actually, once you get over the sort of performances, which they're those kind of like quite naturalistic performances, most of the cast aren't trained actors, I think.
Yeah.
It works really well, it suits the tone, but actually if you take a step back from that, there's an awful lot to enjoy in just the cinematography and the atmosphere of it. Yeah. That I think will probably reward repeat viewings more than the performances necessarily will.
The thing about it is that, and something that so few films do nowadays actually, is it requires effort.
Mm.
And a lot of people simply aren't prepared to put that into watching a film.
Yeah.
Which I guess is okay. People sometimes just want a film simply for escapism. And even if you are prepared to put effort into watching a film, you need to know beforehand that you need to, I think.
Yeah.
It rewards the effort.
But it kind of comes with a steep learning curve. Yeah. Well, not learning curve, that's what I'm going to say, but I've been thinking about it, and it feels like, because the director, Ben Zeitlin, I think it's maybe like his first thing approaching a major feature. Mm-hmm. He's certainly not a particularly well-known director. I think most of his other four or five projects before this are quite low-key affairs.
Just shorts, really, as a director.
Yeah, And I mean, this is certainly still low-key on a budget of just shy of like $1.5 million, I think. But it willfully puts up barriers to the audience, in that the two central characters are a 6-year-old kid and, you know, her father, who at first appears to be a very dismissive figure. He's very aggressive. He seems not physically violent, but he seems sort of very harsh mentally and vocally towards this little girl. And you find it difficult to empathise with him, but at the same
he's
time...
He's never going to win Father of the Year, but unless you're really paying attention, it'd be very, very easy to dismiss him as our brute.
Yeah, it's difficult to get over that. And at the same time, I wasn't sure how I was supposed to empathise with this little girl who, although obviously the sort of the borderline sort of imaginary aspects of the story from her point of view, because she is the narrator, a lot of her experiences are so specific to her locale that I found it difficult to relate to in that sense as well. And it's only if you can get beyond that into sort of the second half of the movie that it all starts to come together and you're eventually rewarded for that time you've invested. So yeah, I don't think the casual viewer is gonna, you know, you're not gonna get this in a double bill with a good Day to Die Hard. It's not gonna play to those two audiences, certainly. But yeah, one of the more unusual and ultimately rewarding films, but I can understand why some people might feel a little let down by it, given sort of the massive esteem it's been held in and sort of the weight of expectation people have put on its shoulders. And also, I find myself struggling, how valid is it for this kid to have been sort of put up on an Oscar bait pedestal as best actress? I can't really get behind that. I'm not saying that it wasn't a great performance, but so how much of this is performance and how much of it is just a 5-year-old kid being a 5-year-old kid?
Mm-hmm. You mean the Oscars? Maybe a cynical PR stunt?
Yes.
Lord, I cannot believe you'd say something so blasphemous.
No, it's not that. It's obviously we know that. I find it almost offensive, and I think maybe I went into it wanting to dislike her performance and wanting to be cynical about it, and ultimately it's quite hard to be. So yeah, no, it's a really, really good film. I didn't take to quite the degree that I'd expected to, but I suspect it may well be up there, and you know, by the end of the year, and one of the best films that I saw this year.
What it does have going for it too is in what is just becoming an increasingly uninteresting cinema landscape, an increasingly flat cinema landscape, is it something different and interesting, but not in a sort of film festival shit way.
Yeah,
there's are plenty of films that we've seen, for instance, at the Edinburgh International Film Festival, that are different from anything you'd see in a cinema, but not for good reasons.
Yeah.
whereas this is one of the few films that really stands out as being different from the rather monochrome landscape, but in a worthwhile way.
Yeah.
I do wonder how my weight of expectations affected this film, because if this had sort of snuck up on you without really knowing too much about it beforehand, then I suspect I would probably have loved it a lot more than I actually did.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, yeah.
I had almost no expectations because I've purposely been trying to avoid as much awards talk as possible for years now, really, if I can avoid it. So I was like, I knew this week kid was nominated, and there was a film called Beast of Southern Wild, and that was genuinely all I knew about it. I'd gone out my way to find out as little as possible, and my feelings about it don't seem to be all that different from either of yours, so I'm not sure whether that would have made a difference or not.
Interesting. No, but definitely one to check out. Available already on streaming services here in the UK, and I should imagine in most other territories, so...
Blu-ray and DVD, I think, by now as well.
Yes, yeah. Yes, available on all avenues, so certainly. Looks like it could be a rainy Sunday this weekend, so check it out. Okay, right off the bat, let me point out this is obviously going to be a loaded introduction. Mamma is the latest horror film coming burdened with that gold standard of approval, which, known as the Guillermo del Toro Presents tagline. Some people are saying it's the best horror film of the year so far. Drew, how much stock should we be putting in that?
It's a bit like saying this year's favourite cancer. I imagine regular listeners will know that I have had something of an embargo on horror films, or normally as I call them, shitty horror films, but it seems a redundant adjective.
You are to horror films what North Korea is to foreign aid.
Right, does that mean I should expect if it's from Dennis Rodmanson?
Yeah. Get your autograph book ready.
So having had this embargo for quite a while, I have been surprised that a couple, and it is only a couple films, and maybe the last 2 years that we've covered in the one-liner that either you or Scott or both of you have seen has been not awful. I was intrigued enough to come out of the end of this embargo, and I was first attracted by the link with Guillermo del Toro, whose work sometimes, even often, isn't all that good, but tends at least to be interesting. It turns out, though, as you said, Craig, that Mamma comes presented by del Toro, an association that seems to mean as much for the Mexican director as it does for Quentin Tarantino, i.e., more or less, sod all. I think it really means, I saw this and I liked it, and that's about the level of investment you get from that.
I saw this film, it needed marketing, and yes. I saw a potentially lucrative back-end deal.
So what do we have in Mamma, then, if not the inventiveness of Guillermo del Toro? Well, not a lot, really. But let's recap the plot first. After murdering his estranged wife and some of her colleagues, upstanding citizen Jeffrey collects his two daughters and disappears with them into the forest with the intention of killing them as well.
Jeffrey!
Yeah, father of the year. In the nick of time, they are saved by a mysterious protector, but are never heard from again. We then move on 5 years and find Jeffrey's brother Luke has never given up on finding his nieces and has used every last dollar paying people to search for them. Conveniently, just as this money runs out, the girls are found, living in a ruined shack in the woods, wild but seemingly unharmed, and are brought back to civilization. Luke seeks guardianship, and eventually the children begin to live with him and his partner Annabelle. But it seems that whoever, or whatever it was, that saved them from their father and looked after them in the cabin, isn't quite ready to give up their charges yet. As I said, we don't have a lot here, other than vindication of my long-standing embargo on horror films. It was Del Toro's name that coaxed me to break it for this, along with the fact that it stars Jessica Chastain, but I really shouldn't have bothered. And it's not a terrible film, Chastain. Well,
sorry.
For varying degrees of terrible, perhaps, varying values of terrible. It's not a terrible film technically, then, perhaps. Chastain, unsurprisingly, is good value. And the acting, on the whole, is pretty decent. Game of Thrones' Nicolas Coster-Waldau as Luke and Megan Charpentier and Isabelle Nelisse as the two girls, Victoria and Lily, are watchable, even though I knew more or less exactly what would happen. I was at least engaged enough to see how it was played out, which is the fact that it got my attention at all is surprising for a horror film.
Mm.
But the fact I could see where it was going was one of the two main problems I had. As Scott mentioned on our Twitter feed, while it may be well put together, it is astonishingly predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And most importantly, most unsurprisingly, and most disappointingly, it is resolutely, almost willfully, not scary. Not even a little. I mean, my eyes rolled so far back in my head after the first orchestral stab that I had to smack the back of my skull to loosen them, generating frights by orchestral stabs. Really, that's where the horror genre still is. I mean, and then, it comes down to this, anything else I've said about Mamma really is irrelevant. It's like a comedy not being funny. It's a horror, and it's not scary in the least. It's not even tense or creepy, which could potentially substitute for out-and-out frights. But it's not. It is, in fact, pish, and a one to avoid.
Scott, is it truly pish?
It's truly pish. I thought for probably 45 minutes or so watching this, like, from very early on, you can get the impression that, right, it's one of these films, is it? I could predict exactly what was going on, and I'm not normally so down on films that do that, because I kind of have a pretty good understanding of how horror films kind of work mechanically now, because we've seen enough of them, because I'm old. But this is marketed at young people who haven't seen that and seem to be a bit more shocked by the kind of things that I was kind of going to count down. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, coming in from the left. Yep. There it is. And it was just so amazingly predictable that I was just sort of sitting back and going, okay, fine. It's, other than the fact that I can tell what's going on, it's well put together. It's reasonably well acted. Jessica Chastain has a good performance in it. It's all put together in the correct way. It does gets a good mileage out of the first couple of acts, just having the kids just being creepy, because little kids are creepy, especially when they're jumping around on top of fridges and things like that. I can see how that would work for people, and I was content to sort of give it a pass. Like, okay, this is one of these horrors that don't really work for me, but at least on a mechanical level, like something like The Possession last year with Jeffrey Dean Morgan. It's fine. I can understand where people are going with it. It's not for me, but for the kind of audiences that haven't seen this kind of thing umpteen times in their life, you know what? They'll get a kick out of it. I'll just give it a pass on that basis. Then it makes the critical mistake that any film like this can do of, when you have a creature as the bad guy in it, it does a decent job for about the first hour or so of keeping it hidden in the shadows and sort of doing the kind of things that it should do, but for the last half hour it's out front and centre, and it is the goofiest looking thing I've seen in a good long while. I mean, it was all I could do to stop myself bursting out from laughing when you get your first good look at this thing's cooping. I mean,
it's no signs, but it's pretty bad.
the goofiest thing since Jaws reared his rubber head and reinvented the dildo.
I mean, if this monster had a battle cry, it should have been duh. And I just looked at that and I'm like, how can anyone be scared by this? This is no. The creature design of this, the character design of the big bad, is just so abysmal that it tipped it from being, okay, this is, you know, well produced but just not my cup of tea, it was something that's just actively, willfully dreadful. It's going out of its way just to be rubbish now. And though it is rubbish, so I suppose in that score it has succeeded. Congratulations, Mama, you're rubbish. Unfortunately, you've done so well, there's already talk of a sequel, so we'll be ignoring this politely in 2 years. I'm preemptively playing my Joker for that particular filmic experience, but no, I do not recommend it, however.
I take it this shambling manifestation of evil is CG rather than practical effect.
I would imagine, yes. I think partially it's
yeah, there must be some physical performance capture in it, because there is somebody listed as the character, although it is a man, but so somebody playing the physical
it
role.
It is a man!
Yeah, and even if it was, well, obviously parts of it are CG, but it's not so obviously CG as something daft like Signs. It's relatively good CG in that respect, but really dreadful CG in all the others.
Is it as good as Dreamcatcher?
Can anything be as good as Dreamcatcher?
Oh. I've done my best to forget that film. I'd almost actually like to watch it again. We should do a commentary of it.
Yes, let's do that.
Let's do that.
Yeah, I'm ill that year.
I had almost considered breaking my horror embargo for Mama myself, but no. Thanks for the heads up, boys.
No, don't do it.
You're a young man.
You've so much to live for.
Unfilmable is a term which silly people like to bandy about quite a bit. It has most recently been applied to Cloud Atlas, an ambitious project, and one which Scott is going to fill us in on now.
Yes, there's rather a lot to recap in Cloud Atlas, if you were foolish enough to make an attempt to try. However, I'm no fool, so let's give it a somewhat more glossed over and amazingly confusing overview. The central premise of Cloud Atlas is to cut between a number of stories with a number of different styles, happening over a number of different time frames with a consistent number of actors. So, for example, you might have Jim Broadbent running around in a contemporary retirement home farce, only for a few minutes later to find him as a captain of a galley sailing back from the New World in the 18th century or something. Amongst these smaller stories, we have such wildly divergent characters and stories, such as Jim Sturgis's young composer apprenticing himself to Broadbent's cantankerous old master.
That's Ben Whishaw. See, that's what's done. There's too many people in it. You've already forgotten which one plays which.
That's true. I'm actually surprised they even got so far as to writing actors' names into this, given how poorly prepared I am. Ben Whishaw's young composer apprenticing himself to Broadbent's cantankerous old master. You have Halle Berry's as a 70s investigative journalist uncovering a conspiracy at Hugh Grant's nuclear power plant. I like to think of it as actually being Hugh Grant's nuclear power plant. And we have futuristic tales of oppression and genetically modified servants, and even further futuristic post-fall tribal Tom Hanks helping outsiders find satellite uplinks, and that's only about the half of it. Oh, and in every single one of these stories, Hugo Weaving is evil. Oh, that Weaving. Cloud Atlas is biting off a hell of a lot of things to chew on. It is to its credit that for the most part, I think it does manage to chew them quite well. It's by no means perfect, and you can pick any number of flaws with them, which I will probably go on to do. But in general, I want to set the tone of being... a general tone of me being quite impressed by the, at least the scope, the imagination and the vision, and for the most part, the execution of this. So I did actually quite like it. However, there's certainly a number of things that it doesn't do very well. It works far better than I kind of figured that it would be, given that it is jumping about in narrative and tone every 3 minutes. You're being bounced around like a bead of sweat in a gym instructor's trunks. It is...
Well, thanks for that image.
Can it just go on with a bouncy ball, no?
How boring you are. But despite that, there's really any number of reasons you can think of that on a logical level and say this simply shouldn't work. But it kind of does, because most of these tales are interesting enough to kind of stand on their own, more or less, as getting towards vignettes rather than full-on stories. But for the most part, these stories kind of work. There's a lot of good performances in there. I can't really think of too many that are actively bad.
Well,
Tom Hanks,
I suppose,
maybe...
it depends on whether you think that Tom Hanks in London is meant to be comedy or not.
Yeah, if Tom Hanks just really shouldn't try and do accents. We've kind of discovered this in the past. It's not his cup of tea.
It's that level, actually. Yes, it's not good.
While it does carry off these sharp changes in tone better than I expected that it would do, you can't get away from the fact there's a number of times where it's just going to be disorienting or weird, and that's never a pleasant experience for any audience to have to sit through. Certainly performances are strong, and that gives it a good reason for existence. If you're going to try and look at this film as part of any kind of wider scheme of, you know, a central narrative that actually spans all of these different time frames, or having any kind of real proper linkage between these stories, as is implied by its tagline of everything being connected, you're in for a bit of a hiding, because everything really isn't connected.
No.
Apart from by some fancy editor. There's some...
It's not quite, though, Babel.
No, it's not quite so bad. There is a very mild and almost coincidental through line throughout these films, but it's really got nothing to do with the central plots of any of these particular stories. And because it is limiting itself to these small looks into each individual character's life, you can only really come up with character development if you take a very grandiose view on the concept of reincarnation of souls across different characters and time frames, which I'm not quite prepared to get on board with, not for a three-hour film. It's a long... Yeah. 3 hours seems like it should be a tremendously long film. I can only say that it didn't feel particularly long when it was in there, probably because it's switching itself up so often that it got away with it.
That's something that surprised me too, Scott. It's a three-hour film, but I really didn't feel it at all.
And it's almost the sort of film
bizarre
where you wish it was a bit longer. Felt that some of these things could actually have been better spun out into given a bit more time to develop.
Yeah,
and some of the characters...
And some of the characters simply don't have enough time if you want to tell the story well.
Yeah,
I've heard more than one person say that it probably would have been better served as like a 6-part TV miniseries.
Yeah,
or
a miniseries
like
I think would have been spot on for something like this. Actually, something on HBO maybe.
Yeah,
give it the time it deserves.
I can certainly get behind that. The other negative, I mean, partly positive, partly negative. Some of the prosthetic works that it's using in sort of changing the characters and their across various time frames, some of it's genuinely great, and you almost wouldn't recognise some of these characters. Mm-hmm. It's done really well. Yeah. Other stuff is done so badly that it must be some kind of joke. I mean, everything in Korea is borderline racist. I mean, it's the same level of sophistication as what was the Bond film where he goes to Japan and they have to make him look Japanese.
He's only lived twice.
They kind of make him look Japanese by sort of giving him a bit of boot polish on his face and drawing slightly slanty eyes on him. That's more or less what the Korean stuff in this is. Hugo Weaving in particular being laughable. But that's more or less an exception. I think a lot of the other stuff is done very well, and visually it's a tremendously lush and lavish film. And
yeah, well, there is some inconsistency there too. Yeah, you've got the Korean stuff as you're talking about. Then you've got Hugo Weaving as the sort of older female nurse who's terrifying, but doesn't look even a tiny little bit like Hugo Weaving. to be quite well to work out, that's who it was. Yeah. It was more just, well, I've not seen him in this section yet. That must be who it is. And then in the same storyline, you've got Hugh Grant with basically just looks like a big load of latex on his face. Yeah. Like, that's Hugh Grant with a big load of latex on his face, you know? The other problem, too, in terms of it trying to suggest that these people are reincarnated souls or whatever, connected by this bizarre comet-like birthmark, and the idea that, like, the same people keep cropping up in different time periods and stuff, it's sort of hamstrung by the fact that they have characters playing, or the same actors playing characters who are actually alive at the same time, so sort of undermine their own efforts there.
Yeah.
Well, Hugh Grant's this guy in the 70s, but also this guy's brother in London at the same time. How's that work?
Yeah, if you're looking for this for deep meaning, I think you will fail.
Yeah.
It's perhaps writing some somewhat pretentious checks that its actuality cannot cash.
No, but it's not quite doing the same thing that previous Wachowski-related stuff, like, for instance, The Matrix Reloaded has done.
No.
It's doing a much more successful job than that managed. And, again, it's notable for being different than so many other films out there, but in a watchable way.
Well, I think for years we've bemoaned the homogeny of the cinematic landscape. And
oh, absolutely, yeah.
This has to be one of the most, certainly the most unique, and it's one of the most grandiose and lavish experiments that you'll see in cinema, mm-hmm. possibly ever.
What is the sort of overarching theme of the source material then? Because I know nothing of it.
Me neither.
No, no idea.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Glad we
great insight there.
Cleared
thanks.
That up. Yeah.
thanks for exposing my ignorance.
It's just kind of a film that's there.
It's not been quite so prevalent in recent years, but the kind of fractured narrative thing that was in every era, like Alexandre Aux Iñárritu film, that kind of thing, which was annoying me no end. Maybe 5 years ago. It's not quite so prevalent now, but I suppose this is the logical conclusion of it, because you can't get a narrative more fractured than this one. And
I think it's time we reevaluated 21 grams.
Do I need to reevaluate it? Is there a commentary on that one then?
No, let's not.
There's any number of reasons why you could think of this and just check out and not care about it in the slightest. I would heartily recommend, if anyone's thinking of going to see this, if you've not seen a trailer for it already, or some of the 5-minute promos of the characters and the Wachowskis and Tom Twyker kind of explaining what the central narrative and the central concept of it is, give those a bash before you go in. You may save yourself 3 hours, because you may easily, and I would have probably very little argument with people who kind of think of the general concept of this and go, nope, stupid idea. And I wouldn't really complain about them too much. But if you're on board with its grandiose central concept, then I think this delivers. It works far more often than it doesn't work, which is a success given the scope and the...
Works better than it has any right to. Is that fair to say?
Yes. That's about the size of it, yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
But it's not going to set the world alight.
No. See, I don't know if it really says more for the cinematic landscape or for this film, that just the fact it's different is reason enough to watch it. Fortunately, I mean, it is good in its own right. It's just, you feel it could be better. And it's not a great film, but Scott said it's worth a watch. I don't have much to add to what he said, though. So I'll stop talking now.
Yay! Cool. Well, that just about wraps it up for tonight then, I think. Do we have anything else to add?
I love you, each and every one of you.
Aw, heartfelt sentiment from Scott there. I'd love to share that sentiment, but I'm afraid I can't. Yeah, so listen, thank you for giving us your time once again. Remember, it would help massively if you guys took just 10 seconds to pop over to our iTunes listing and give us a little rate and a review. Also, feel free to follow us on Twitter, @TheOneLiner, all one word. You will also find us there individually by profile. We're not too hard to find, should you have any desire to follow us individually. Other than that...
Why wouldn't you?
Well, exactly. Oh, and you can email us at podcast@theoneliner.com if you're still into that whole 2000s thing of email. I, as always, was Craig. Scott was Scott.
Goodbye.
And Drew was undoubtedly Drew.
Hear thee well.
When the Drew is found to be Drew...
I'm never getting a proper outro, am I?
Never. I'm working hard on it each time. One day I'll run out. One day I'll run out. Cheerio, guys. Bye.
There's not too much to be said about the story at all, really. It's character.
Would you want another medal, Muttley?